Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A shocking expose of the deadliest killing spree in Canadian history and how police tragically failed its victims and survivors. As news broke of a killer rampaging across the tiny community of Portapique, Nova Scotia, late on April 18th, 2020, details were oddly hard to come by. Who was the killer? Why was he not apprehended? What were police doing? How many were dead? And why was the gunman still on the loose the next morning and killing again? The RCMP was largely silent then and continued to obscure the actions of denturist Gabriel Wortman after an officer shot and killed him at a gas station during a chance encounter. Though retired as an investigative journalist and author, Paul Pelango spent much of his career reporting on Canada's troubled national police force, watching the RCMP stumble through the Portapique massacre only a few hours from his Nova Scotia home. Pelango knew the story behind the headlines was more complicated and damning than anyone was willing to admit. With the COVID-19 lockdown sealing off the Maritimes, no journalist in the province knew the RCMP better than Pelango did. Within a month, he was back in print and on the radio, peeling away the layers of this murderous episode as only he could, and unearthing the collision of failure and malfeasance that cost the quiet community 22 innocent lives. The book that we're featuring this evening is 22 Murders, Investigating the Massacres, Cover-Up, and Obstacles to Justice in Nova Scotia, Part 2, with my special guest, investigative author and journalist, Paul Pelango. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for this interview, Paul Pelango.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be back.
Thank you so much. People are highly anticipating this Part 2 of this incredible, I know I overuse that word, but incredible story and remarkable book. Let's get to where we were last time. We were talking about your ongoing investigation and your use of media anywhere you could, podcasts and radio. You talked about Rick Howe radio show and your ability and your willingness to resort to some controversy and ask some hard questions to get some people to come forward. Now, we hadn't mentioned somebody that's instrumental in helping you in this investigation, and that was Chad Jones. Tell us a little bit about Chad Jones and what some of the investigation that he does leads to in terms of a person named Leon Jodray.
Chad Jones. Okay, I came across Chad Jones in an unusual way. I was approached by a podcaster called Little Gray Cells who do a YouTube channel. And this is all unfamiliar territory to me. You know, I'm an old guy who does radio, TV, and the computer. And I, you know, didn't know much about podcasts. And Little Gray Cells and their host, who went by the name Seamus Gorman, but whose actual name was Paul Ragona, had me on. And I think I was on a couple of times. And there was a panel of three on his end. There was him, a guy named Steve, and this other guy called NS Guy, who had sort of a ponytail or his hair tied back in a ponytail. And we chatted. And as we chatted in the, you know, the one or two times that I was there, I think it was two, I was really impressed by the questions that NS Guy asked and his apparent intellect. And at some point we arranged to have a private conversation. I told him to call me. I had something. And we got talking and I realized that, you know, he was an unusual guy. He, you know, I needed help. And I couldn't, you know, I started out trying to help other journalists with what I knew and what I could sense about the story and, you know, help them with accessing good sources that I had inside the RCMP and outside the RCMP.
Right.
And I couldn't get them. So I got Chad and I sort of had a meeting of minds. You know, we went up to Portapique together and started scouting out the various locations and trying to do timing on what the RCMP said they did and what they actually did, what the possibilities were. And really, we started mapping out the story together. And eventually, I became to call Chad, I had a nickname for him, Artificial Intelligence, because anytime I had a question, I would just call Chad up and instantaneously, this 33-year-old guy who worked as a distribution manager in Halifax, he knew the answer to everything very quickly. And plus he was monitoring what was going on in the wider community in cyberspace.
Now, tell us about the circumstances in which you get to interview this Leon Jodre and what exactly is his account and what does he have to say?
Well, the difficulty in telling the story, as I pointed out in the previous episode, the prime minister had said, you know, we don't want to glorify Gabriel Wortman's infamy. We should not name him. And then the Canadian media dutifully went along with that right across the board, alternative media, mainstream media. So now we had the perpetrator. And then we had his common-law wife of 19 years who was never named in print. Like getting her name was almost impossible.
Right.
Trying to figure out who she was until Frank Magazine, the satire magazine in Halifax, wrote a piece about her and cleverly described her as a hero just so nobody would come back at them and, sort of pick at their offices for outing Lisa Banfield and her name. So they sort of did it in a tongue-in-cheek way.
Right.
And I wanted to know more about Lisa Banfield. And as you see in the story, the other thing that was going on, my health wasn't so good at the time. My wife's health wasn't so good at the time. And we had COVID lockdowns. So we never really left home. You know, at one point in Nova Scotia, you weren't even allowed to leave your county.
Right.
And eventually a sunny day came and Chad and I said, okay, let's go. He says, you got to meet Leon Jodre. And he arranged it because on his own as a citizen investigator, he was identifying other people because there's so many people in this story. Potentially, there's 22 victims and there's the police and there's the politicians. There's so many angles to go that, you could tie up a lot of a newsroom just following all the angles. So there was just the two of us at this point. And we said, okay, well, let's drive up to Portapique. And it was like a 2-hour drive. And we got there and we met Leon at a restaurant. I think it called the CNC, and as I joke about it, Chad used to call it the chew and choke as a joke.
Right.
You know, like a typical thing they do in rural communities, which wasn't fair. The food was pretty good. And we met Leon, and then he took us on his version of the story, which was very compelling.
Well, you write that what with the narrative from police, from the RCMP, was that they hadn't been in contact with her at all till 6:30 in the morning when she came out of the woods. Leon was telling you that she came to his cabin.
Well, it's not a cabin. It's a house.
Okay, it's a house. But the narrative was totally contradictory to what she had said and what the RCMP had said and what the media had reported. So Tell us the difference, the vast difference.
Well, the RCMP narrative is this woman was beaten, dragged, kicked, shot at, you know, forced to wash her. The cottage burned down. The warehouse burned down. She is tied up, handcuffed in the back of a decommissioned police car, crawled through the silent patrolman that separates the front and back seat, escaped into the bush, and hid out for 8.5 hours dressed in yoga pants and a spandex top. She had no jacket, no gloves, no boots. And they said she arrived at, you know, 6:30, came out of the woods just as the RCMP was going home. The old RCMP officers went home at 6:30 because they presumed, so they said, that Wortman had committed suicide. And right around this time, she comes out of the woods and goes to Leon Jodry's house. The RCMP goes rescue her, take her to the hospital, and then everything really goes silent. You don't know anything really about Lisa Banfield. And so we went and saw Wortman, and that word, we went and saw Leon Jodry, and his version of the story was somewhat different. Leon is one of the few people who survive this onslaught in Port Epic. Remember, 13 people are killed. At the time, there might have been probably 18 to 20 people residing in houses at that time of the year. It's right. More a seasonal community. Mm-hmm. So most of the people there were wiped out by Wortman. And the night before, Leon, who was, you know, he worked in the forest. He worked for the Provincial Department of Natural Resources. He did a lot of forestry work. Strong guy. His neighbors, Jamie and Greg Blair, were cleaning up their property for, you know, the spring cleanup and cutting out some bush. And him and Leon and another guy helped them that day, taking bush down to the beach, because once a year, a couple of times a year, they'd have a giant bonfire down there, a big party in the neighborhood with this giant fire on the waters of the Bay of Fundy.
Right.
And then they went back to Jamie and Greg's house, had dinner at around 9 o'clock. He went home because he's a early to bed, early to rise kind of guy. In the middle of the night, he said he remembers it exactly at 3:33 a.m. He remembered smelling smoke. And he said the smoke was not wood burning. It was something else. And so he was quite alarmed by it. And after he thought about it, he got in his truck and he roared around the neighborhood in the dark. And there were no police there. And eventually he goes about a kilometer and a half, well, you know, almost a mile from his place to Gabriel Wortman's cottage at 200 Port Epic Beach Road. And there's a police armored vehicle sitting there, and the property's in cinders. And the police just tell him to turn around and go back and get out of there, which is kind of odd.
Right.
Because they still hadn't found Wortman. How did they know it wasn't Wortman? They just sent him away. So he roared around the other way up to the intersection, down Orchard Beach Drive, went past Greg Blair's house. He saw it wasn't on fire. It was only 4 o'clock in the morning. He wasn't going to go in there. Drove down a little farther, turned around, came up, didn't notice that he had driven past two bodies lying by the side of the road, you know, Corey Ellison on one side, Leon's old girlfriend, Lisa McCulley, on the other side,
right
behind the fence. Drives back to his place, starts texting and trying to find out what's going on in his neighborhood. Makes himself a coffee at 6:30. You know, the sun's coming up. There's a knock at the door, and it's Lisa Banfield. And he says, you know, what are you doing here? And, you know, Gabriel doesn't like me. And Lisa says, oh, I'll leave. And she turned around to leave, and Wortman said, no, you can't go. She said, Gabriel's gone crazy, and he brought her into the house. And right away, he said he noticed her makeup was perfect. And she said she had these skimpy clothes on, and she said she'd been out all night in the woods. And it was zero degrees Celsius, which is 32 degrees Fahrenheit that night, and cold because it's a windy, windy place there. You know, the Bay of Fundy has the highest tides in the world.
Right.
You can imagine the wind right beside there, all constant. Mm-hmm. So he called 911 and got the operator, told him what was going on. I have Gabriel Wortman's girlfriend here, da 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 da. And within 3 minutes, SWAT team members were there, or ERT members for the RCMP. They, you know, Leon gave her some shoes to wear, something to cover up, a blanket. The police took her away, and they basically didn't search his house, didn't search his property. He said their behavior was really, really strange in his opinion. And from the outset, he said, I don't believe her story. You know, he said She didn't smell of gasoline. She didn't look like she'd been in the woods. This is a guy who knows the woods there.
Right.
And if you look at the woods, they're almost impossible to travel. The roads are gravel. Walking barefoot around the woods for 8.5 hours. I mean, Lisa said at one point she hid in a tree stump. And I thought, what is this, like Lord of the Rings? And Leon pretty well thought the same thing. So he wanted to tell his story, and he would tell everyone his story. And it was very convincing. He's the kind of guy who looks you in the eye and tells you the story. But nobody wanted to hear his story. So the media would never report Leon's version of events. They'll talk about Lisa Banfield going to his house, but never that Leon thought didn't believe her story. And as I started to examine this story and eventually started reporting on it, others would be reporting on the story, like Global News, for example, did a podcast, 13 and a half hours. CBC did stories on it. Other reporters did story. And all they would do is report the version of the story that Lisa Banfield told to the police, and the RCMP would tell this story. And when they were confronted by it, why did they use Leon Jodry's story? Global News, for example, on two occasions said, well, his version of events doesn't fit the police version of events. And that's the kind of reporting we were getting. There was no skepticism, no suspension of disbelief about the RCMP story, even though there were obvious holes in it. And when you could prove that there was something wrong with the story, other reporters would just ignore it, where they're going to stick to the narrative that the police had given them. And that sort of forced me forward into digging deeper and starting to come up with the idea. I was going to have to write a book here, because no one is going to listen to the real story.
What we didn't mention too is that part of her story was that she had been handcuffed in the back of one of these police cars, and then she had escaped. What was his observance regarding the handcuff or handcuffs?
Well, he saw no handcuffs. There were no handcuffs. You know, I think she may have said, oh, I slipped out of the handcuffs. But in later, as I did the investigation and met other people who were in the community, including one woman, Cindy Sterrett, who is sort of one of Wertman's regular girlfriends up there. And she had worked at an adult shop and had gifted some S&M type handcuffs, bondage handcuffs, to Wertman, and along with other toys. And those handcuffs had a safety button on a release button that you'd take off. So the question became, was she really handcuffed, or what were these S&M handcuffs part of the show? But we still don't have an answer to that 2 years down the road.
When you talk about the narrative that the police had, tell us about this, you know, prelude to to the killings itself. And this was supposed to be their anniversary, their 19th anniversary this night. So they drove around, according to her. What did they do in this drive, according to her?
On that day, they had a criminal who we may or may not get to here, Peter Griffin.
Yes.
Working, you know, who has spent time in jail for drug trafficking, had associations with the La Familia cartel in Mexico and MS-13. And the Hells Angels. He was their yard boy. And he was recently on parole or just off parole for a previous conviction. They went for a ride around sort of northern Nova Scotia, according to Banfield, that they visited a few places that subsequently Wertman would return to the next day and kill some people. But they also went to Spring Hill, where there's a prison, a federal prison. And he gifted some of his dentist equipment to another dentist there, saying he was getting out of the business. They drove by another dentist's cottage. Her name was Gina Golay, who turned out to be his last victim. And Lisa Banfield told the police she didn't know how Wertman knew where Golay's place was. It's interesting to note that when the police first told this story, they didn't have the cottage in the story. They led people to believe that he had driven by Gina Goulet's house, which was about almost an hour's drive in the other direction,
right,
towards Halifax. So it was all sort of vague. And the story was portrayed as he was driving around, Wertman was driving around staking out places. But along the way, he went to the prison. They looked at the prison, and he told Lisa, I'm never going in there, which suggests there was something going on in his mind that either he was under investigation or something was going on to make him fear going into the prison. His uncle had been in prison. And meanwhile, he had three other relatives who were RCMP police. So he was in this sort of this in-between world. And there was obviously things on his mind. You know, he was depressed. Friends said he was drinking a lot again. And he was concerned about going to jail. They returned home around 5 o'clock that night, and then they went and apparently went over to the warehouse, which is about 400 meter walk through the woods, and were having a virtual party. This is the police story, with a couple in Maine, and someone said about a recommit, you know, said they should have a recommitment ceremony the next year. And apparently this led to a fight between Wortman and Lisa Banfield. And then the events happened. The murders began to happen. That's the official story. To me, it didn't pass the smell test.
Before we talk about your further investigation, people are familiar with Peter Griffin, but only in this limited way, in that he was responsible supposedly for the decal on the police car, on the replica car, the manufacturing of that. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Peter Griffin, he is this odd, this character who I identified in the summer of 2020, his name had not been in the press and the RCMP hadn't released it. They said that the person who put the decals on the police car, like dressed up a fully functional looking police car, right, wasn't going to be charged, and they were innocent victims. And I started to look, I heard rumors from various sources about this drinking group that Wortman had of the Friday afternoon club.
Right.
And they said there were some heavy dudes there, that what I was told, and other people. And I eventually figured out that one of the people was Peter Allen Griffin. And he had been arrested in Edmonton back in 2014 or so. With heavy-duty drug smuggling, weapons, and with links, as I said, to La Familia, MS-13. And his own grandmother was associates with the Hells Angels. And they were family friends, the two brothers named the Mercero brothers, especially Randy Mercero. So this is a sort of this, you start getting into the biker world that exists in an organized crime world in Colchester, with all these relationships that are very close to Wortman and the activities he was involved in.
Another breakthrough you talk about that was very important in this, as your further investigation, was a person named Laura Graham. What do you learn as a result of what she tells you, Laura Graham?
You have to understand that, okay, we're now like 9 months down the road. The RCMP is refusing to release any real documents about what happened. They're making the media fight to get at what are called informations to obtain search warrants, and they're heavily redacted. So it's almost impossible to figure out what is going on, what they did. They're not identifying any officers who were at the scene. They contended that they were working on a major investigation, which I knew was a cover, because that's usually what they do. They shut all kind of discussion down, saying they're working on an investigation. And no investigation ever happens, because the RCMP, as I showed in my previous books, was really good at building files, but not building cases. So I'm suspicious of them doing that. And I eventually did a story that begins this sort of sequence, this tumbling sequence into the deeper story. So first of all, I write up a new sort of timeline for what was happening based on new information I had, but I couldn't get anyone to publish it. And it was like frustrating as hell trying to get it published. Nobody would, it's too long, it's too local. Well, we've already done this. We've already plowed this field. You know, why would we do it again? And it wasn't. It was like elaborating on, and I felt that the story would open up new doors. So anyway, I finally got the story published in Frank magazine, made a deal with them. And I said, look, I'll do this for Frank, but you can't sort of make my sort of voice cheeky and satirical. I'm going to do straight reporting with some sort of analysis in every story. So Andrew Douglas, the editor, said, go ahead and do it. So we did it. And that attracted the attention of Jordan Bonaparte, who works in the insurance industry, but does a podcast out of Halifax and then on the Global Network. That Jordan had me on one Sunday night, and then it was like 11:30 and I was falling asleep recounting this story. I was trying to stay awake. It was really, I had a long day. Then lo and behold, I get a message just before Christmas 2020 saying, I heard you on Jordan and what you were talking about. 9 months earlier, I remember that night, my husband was snoring and I woke up and I do this crazy thing. I have a scanner app on my phone and I look around for where the most activity is. And that night it was in Pictou County, Nova Scotia, which is sort of 60 miles, you know, 90 kilometers. So an hour drive northeast of Port of Pic, more east of Port of Pic. I thought to myself, why would they be in Pictou County, Nova Scotia? Why would they be using the radio there? So anyway, it took about 10 days for me to get Laura on side. And then she finally showed me the scanner app and what she'd done and came forward. So she lived in Orangeville, Ontario, which is outside of Toronto, about 40-minute drive northwest of Toronto, just, you know, northwest of the airport in Toronto. And she heard this. She was embarrassed about going on, you know, being identified. She didn't want people to know that she listened to a scanner app, but she was really concerned because she had heard policemen wandering around in the dark, finding bodies, not knowing where they are, getting GPS locations to identify where the bodies are, but a man hiding in the woods, and this whole sort of chaotic situation going on. Remember, this is 9 months later, and I'd say, well, what time was that? She said, well, it was like 2 o'clock. And I said, well, how do you know it was 2 o'clock? She says, because I remember I woke up at this time and that time, and this is what happened. I remember looking at the clock, and I remember this was around 2 o'clock, which means it was around 3 o'clock in Pictou, Nova Scotia, because Nova Scotia is on Atlantic time. So we went, so I had to try to find the Pictou County tapes, and I had this other citizen investigator named Pete Stevens, who knew, seemed to know all this stuff. And I said to Pete, you know, I'm looking for archives of, does anyone archive these kind of things? And he said, I don't know that, but I know a guy. And 20 minutes later, another citizen investigator says, here's where you find them. And it was on the US channel called Broadcastify. So I bought a membership to Broadcastify, and Chad and I bought memberships, I should say. And then we downloaded all of these things, found the tapes, and now we could hear what the Mounties were doing exactly like Laura said at 3:03 a.m., 2:03 her time. The police found the body of Corey Ellison, but then they marked it. They found Lisa McCauley's body. They marked it, and then they just left it there sitting outside. They didn't put any yellow tape around. I think they put tarps over them at that point. And the bodies were lying there till like at least 9:30 in the morning when other neighbors, Judy Myers and her husband, Doug, were evacuated from the community and drove up Orchard Beach Drive. And the bodies were still lying there. There was no tape, no nothing, no police guard. The police all went home and left them there. So this was an important step in the progress of the story, because to be able to show this now opened up other doors. People began to see that I wasn't just blowing smoke about the RCMP incompetence and what, and raising questions about what was going on. I was no longer a conspiracy theorist raising questions. I actually had hard facts showing there was a problem here. And that became the importance of Laura Graham, because that opened the doors for other people to step forward.
Let's use this opportunity, Paul, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Grove. Did you know that only 9% of plastic actually gets recycled, no matter how much we put in our recycling bin? At Grove Collaborative, they believe it's time to ditch single-use plastics for good. Grove carries hundreds of products aimed at replacing single-use plastics across your home and personal care routine. And by 2025, Grove will be 100% plastic-free. Like Grove Co.'s concentrated cleaners and refillable glass bottles, they're friendlier to the planet and twice as effective as the leading natural brands. Switch to sustainable products for every room in your home, from laundry care to hand soaps and more. Grove Co. has you covered with safe formulas and refillable packaging that never compromise on performance. My wife Lisa works as a massage therapist, and she was excited to see all the amazing products from Grove. She immediately ordered Grove's hand sanitizer gel and a blood orange scent made with essential oils. She and her patients loved it. It kills 99% of germs in 30 seconds and meets CDC guidelines but it contains moisturizing aloe, coconut, jojoba, and sunflower seeds oils that hydrate instead of drying out skin. With every one of Grove's hundreds of products being non-toxic, effective, sustainable, and cruelty-free, Lisa and I think Grove's approach is revolutionary. So join over 2 million households already shopping sustainably at Grove. Go to grove.com/truemurder today to get a free gift set worth up to $50 with your first order. Plus, shipping is fast and free. Get started right now at grove.com/truemurder. grove.com/truemurder. Now, Paul, we were talking about this, the effect of this 9/11 tapes and the release. And you also find out about Peter Griffin being evacuated while other people are still trapped in the home of Lisa McCulley. So tell us what you find out and what is the reaction of this release of the 911 tapes, and what does it lead to?
Well, the first reaction is the typical one, that the mainstream media wasn't interested in this. I mean, one reporter, we gave it to reporters. We gave the tapes and the access to all reporters saying, here they are. We're telling you where they are. Download this before we do a story so that, you know, in case they're removed, at least you have them. Not one mainstream reporter did anything about them. In fact, one reporter, when we gave them the tape, said, oh, I'm going to my cottage on the weekend. Maybe I'll listen to them and see if there's anything on them.
Wow.
You know, that's how sort of lackadaisical and uninterested they were in covering the story. They couldn't see what the issue was because the RCMP said they were doing the right thing. So that was totally ignored. But we wrote the story, and then that opened up all kinds of other avenues that we saw the Griffin family. But to understand this, like the story on Portapique Beach Road, there's only one house, you know, like over a mile down on the water side. And that was Gabriel Wortman's log cabin cottage. Beautiful place. On the other side, past Wortman's house on the south, on the east side, going south towards the water, there was a house owned by John Zoll and Elizabeth Joanne Thomas, who'd moved in there about 3 years earlier. And across the street from that was the Griffin house owned by Alan and Joanne Griffin, Peter's parents. And Peter lived in a shack nearby that he was staying there. At 11, so everything's, the police arrive at 10:26. When they arrive, they go down Portapique Beach Road. Three of them go down there. Apparently, they go down there anyways. I'm not sure I believe the story entirely. But they go down there, even though the three 911 calls, the 1001, 1016, and 1026, came from the parallel road, Orchard Beach Drive. And there's no interconnection between those two other than at the top of the intersection where they intersect. And then they run roughly parallel. So the police went down there. They scuttered around. The Wortman's cottage was on fire. And then the Zoll's house was on fire. We're not clear when it's on fire. We still, 2 years down the road, don't have a lot of detail about what happened there. But it was right next to the Griffin house. So at the Griffin house, they could see what was going on from at the Wortman's place because it was across a little bend in the water, in the bay there. It's the mouth of the Portapique River. There's a little bend there, and it was straight across. They could see it. And just to the right would be the Zoll house on fire. Meanwhile, on Orchard Beach Drive, we had calls from four kids, two 12-year-olds and two 10-year-olds, the children of Lisa McCulley and the Blairs, who had been murdered, hiding in a basement, apparently on the phone they were on the phone beginning at 10:16 with a 911 operator who was, to hear the tapes, you can find them on the internet. We got those tapes eventually, and they showed these children dealing with what could only be described as a feckless 911 operator who was more concerned with the fires than the point that one of the children was saying, my daddy's lying dead on the front porch. My mom was shot, and Gabriel Wortman did it. He's dressed like a policeman. He's in a police car, and he did all these terrible things to my mother. And the 911 operator is saying, did you get the license number on the car? and the 12-year-old is going no. So anyway, these kids are trapped there, but at 11:30, roughly in that area between 11:30 and 12 o'clock, the RCMP mount a rescue of the Griffins and escort them out of the community before the kids.
Yeah.
And they're saying, well, now they're saying, well, we knew the kids were there. We had them protected and we had a password to go get them out. And they eventually get the kids out at 1 o'clock in the morning. The kids were there for 3 hours. Trapped in the basement, but the RCMP never take command of the situation. So imagine they take Griffin out. Why did you take Griffin out? He's a criminal.
Right.
What was the issue with Griffin? So it raises questions about, is there a relationship between the police and Griffin? And after Griffin was evacuated, he disappeared. Like he was taken out to a point, his parents met with relatives, then he disappeared for like a day. We don't know what happened to Griffin. We don't know what he's doing. He has never talked. Meanwhile, the kids are trapped in the basement at McCulley's house, and we know that Lisa McCulley is lying dead on the front lawn by the rail fence. And across the road, 18 meters away, you know, like 18 yards roughly, is Corey Ellison lying dead. And their bodies are there all night into the morning, and we still don't know when the bodies were removed on the Sunday. That's how lackadaisical the response was. And again, raises questions about what was really going on.
Now, we haven't spoken about this, but I mean, obviously this is a huge issue, is the police not containing and believing in that somehow he had committed suicide. And that's when we have the police leaving in the morning, figuring that they'd heard a couple shots and concluding that he had killed himself and hence was no longer a threat. So tell us further of your investigation, what you find out, what actually happened.
Well, there's lots of shots people hear during the night. Some think that it's, you know, it's munitions going off from the four fires in the neighborhood. Was it four fires? The four fires in the neighborhood. His house, the warehouse, the Galenchin house, and the Zoll house. But Judy Myers and Doug Myers, who lived down near Cobequid Court, where the three Tuck family members were murdered and the Bond family members next door were murdered, Joy and Peter Bond, she remembers distinctly hearing shots at 11:28 p.m. because she was just getting ready. The evening news was, local news was almost over, and she's getting ready to watch The Honeymooners, the old TV show. She remembers specifically that happening. Others remember hearing shots later. And then the RCMP said, well, we heard one shot in the middle of the night, and we assumed that he was this kind of killer and that he was committing suicide. And they never attempted to find the body, partly because they didn't have the equipment. As we talked about in the previous episode, they didn't have any night vision gear. They didn't have a helicopter for heat seeking. They didn't have any of these things for one reason or the other. So they assume that it's a cold night. It's all died down. The fires burned out because they wouldn't let the fire department in to fight any of the fires. They wouldn't let ambulances in because they didn't know where Wortman was. And they literally went to sleep. The final point was that on the tapes that we recovered, on the Pictou County tapes, what they revealed was the chaos in supervision. And at 1:34 in the morning, roughly, I think it's 1:30 or 1:24 in the morning, a staff sergeant takes over as the incident commander. And the staff sergeant, Jeffrey West, is the head of the traffic division.
Right.
That's what he was the guy in charge making the calls. The one thing you'd think the head of traffic division would know how to do is put up roadblocks and stop people. But none of that ever happens. So they go home. They're convinced he's dead. They didn't have a count on the cars, how many decommissioned police cars Wortman had. And they just forgot about it until the morning when 40 minute drive away in Wentworth, another fire breaks. So reports come in around 9:15 in the morning about a fire and gunshots. And Wortman had been holed up for 3 hours at the home of corrections officers Sean McLeod and Alana Jenkins. Then he kills volunteer firefighter Tom Bagley.
Right.
And then begins this whole trip down, killing people along the way to throw the RCMP off.
You find that he stays at the McLeod and Jenkins resident mysteriously for 3.5 hours. Did you find out any reasoning for that whatsoever?
Nobody knows. Like the theory was, oh, well, he went there because he knew Sean McLeod had weapons
right.
and ammunition. Well, that sort of throws a, a wrench into the monkey works of the RCMP narrative, because the RCMP narrative is that Wortmann was smuggling guns and weapons across the border, and he was building up this terrible reserve of weapons that was going to carry out this long planned assault and kill all of these people. But it appears that he ran out of ammunition. So how much did he have?
Yeah.
And he only had a handful of, he had like a couple of pistols, a rifle, and I think another gun, like four or five guns. It's not like he was overly armed in the classic sense. Why did he go up there? I mean, there have been some debate. You know, the McLeod family believes, the Jenkins family denies that Alanna Jenkins was involved in anything, or that she even knew Wortmann either in a passing way. The McLeod family says there was a previous relationship there. Others say there was a previous relationship between Jenkins and Wortmann. And then there are questions about, you know, if Wortmann was smuggling drugs, this does raise questions about his relationship with two corrections officers, one in a female prison, one in a male federal prison. And why did he go there? Like, it's, nobody really knows. Then the other thing that comes out of this, I was just talking to Scott McLeod, Sean McLeod's brother, the other day, and he said, I saw the recent photos of the corrections services jacket they say that Wortmann took from my brother after he'd killed him, and that he had in the car when he was finally shot. He said, that's not a corrections service jacket. It's a blue jacket. Our jackets are green. And it looked like it was sort of like a homemade thing, that it wasn't real. And that's never really been discussed. That, you know, the RCMP has continued to pass this off as another piece of paraphernalia from law enforcement that Wortmann had gathered, but it doesn't seem to be an authentic piece. And that's never really been addressed.
Another thing that doesn't fit this narrative of this injustice collector necessarily, with staying 3.5 hours at these correctional officers' place, murdering them, was the sexual relationships that were discovered with Wortmann himself. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that Wortmann was a hypersexual guy. And the more you get into it, you start to see that there's all, like, he's this crazy guy who built little miniature coffins, even showed one of his clients in Dartmouth a big coffin he had built in his back room of his denture clinic. He collected motorcycles, et cetera, but what we learn is that he was always measuring men and women for sex. For example, as disgusting as it seems, he'd measure their mouths to see if he would fit in.
Yeah.
And often basically get involved with some of his clients and one of his girlfriends. Crazy things happen. Back in the neighborhood, he had an ongoing relationship with Lisa McCulley, who had also had a long a relationship with Leon Jodry in between. He had a relationship with Gina Goulet, his last victim. He was reportedly seen by others, police, law enforcement people in the Caribbean once with Alanna Jenkins. And he was wearing at that time, an RCMP t-shirt or something like that. And it caused one of the policemen who were there on vacation saying, approach him. Oh, you on the job? And they said, Wortmann just turned around and walked away and never showed up again. It wasn't seen for a long time. So he had this sort of, all this strange stuff going on, but he never had problems, it seems, with women. There were women all over who were happy to be with him, which was like, he was like crazy, paranoid. He just seemed like the kind of guy who would be struggling to do that. But he had it's clear that he had this soft side that appealed to a lot of women. A number of women said he was fun to talk to, and he was this and he was that, and they never saw a dark side. So this raises questions too.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
About Lisa Banfield's claims about him being violent all the time, because nobody else has come forward and said this. And I'm sure there were some domestic violence issues, but it's like reading about, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. there seem to be some violent accusations of violence in that relationship on both sides. And you have to wonder if that's the case here, if there was some sort of quid pro quo in a very sick relationship. So, you know, you get into the injustice collector and things like that, and it doesn't really sell. There's something else going on here. At one point, you know, I do speculate in the book, he's so hypersexual, gets in people's faces, has no sense of distance. It's almost like he has Asperger's or something, or undetected Asperger's. There's something not quite right about him, but he seemed harmless to a lot of people, even though he had all these violent things going on in the subtext of his life.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now let's get to the Mass Casualty Commission. At first, the RCMP do not want to do anything approaching any kind of official inquiry. There's a review. But also, we'll talk about the investigation that you have in New Brunswick and what you discover about Hell's Angels investigations and prosecutions in New Brunswick.
Well, my sources said there's something big here that's bigger than the 22 murders, what they were trying to do. And I tried to figure out, like, what is it? So the only thing that sort of made sense was Wertman was a police agent. Wertman or someone close to him was a police agent or confidential informant, some sort of protected asset. But if he's a protected asset, where was he working? The RCMP denied that he worked for the RCMP, but that was the RCMP in Nova Scotia.
Sure.
I know how the RCMP, like in a previous book, I had a chapter called Shades of Truth, how the RCMP tells a story.
Right.
And they don't really tell the truth. In fact, someone commented on reading the book, said, who worked with the RCMP yesterday, told me, I read your book, and he said, hey, did you notice that every time that something major come up, their first response was a lie, and then you prove it? And I'm glad you saw that. So I started to look at this issue of undercover operatives. So where are they working? Well, if they're working not in Nova Scotia, what if he's working in New Brunswick? It's only like a 35, 40-minute drive from Port of Pic to the New Brunswick border. And Moncton, the major city, is right, you know, like another 30 minutes away. And when I looked into New Brunswick, what I saw, curiously, was 10 days before the rampage began on April 18th. So on April 10th, 2020, four people were charged. Two of them were Hell's Angels. Two were from Hell's Angels puppet clubs. And in the press release, the RCMP went out of their way to talk about two members of the Hell's Angels Nomads, right, who are the elite of the Hell's Angels. They don't have a club.
Right.
They wander. And those two guys were Robin Moulton and Emery Pitt Martin. Then I talked to police sources, and they kept saying to me, there was some informants got blown, their cover got blown, or something happened, and these informants were killed. And I tried to find this. I mean, there's no press release like that, no cases like that. So I eventually start going through all the missing persons and murders in New Brunswick, and then come up with this court case where the probate judge has banned publication of anything going on in this case of these two murder victims, Bernard and Rosemarie Saulnier in Dieppe, just outside of Moncton. Well, it turns out my police sources eventually told me, as I investigated this, that the Saulnier's son, one of their sons, was involved with the Hell's Angels, and he was running a drug operation, and they were concerned about it. The parents were concerned about it. And according to my source, reported to the RCMP what was going on. A big raid took place in August 2019. On September 6, 2019, charges were laid. That night, the Saulniers were murdered,
right,
and horribly murdered. Mr. Saulnier was really bad. It was really bad what happened to him. And then I also learned that one of the people who was there had disappeared, which raised questions about what happened to him. His name was Brady Tompkins. This has never been reported, so I'm reporting this for the first time in the book. And then Tompkins' connection, so we're going in two directions here. One is, Wortman bragged that he could make bodies disappear to people. The RCMP even report this in some of their police documents that he made these assertions. Well, I started to wonder who disappeared. So I started looking at various people who disappeared. It was Wortman involved that way. Secondly, I hear that an RCMP staff sergeant who was involved with the undercover operations in New Brunswick committed suicide. His name was Bruce Reed. He committed suicide. The RCMP version of events was he had personal problems. My sources told me that he was distraught about what happened to two informants who were killed.
Right.
And that seemed to be the Saulnier's, because he operated out of the Hampton sub-detachment just south of Moncton. And that was responsible. That detachment was responsible for a lot of the undercover operations going on in the New Brunswick area.
Right. So with this, you make, how do you tie Wortman to these cases? What is the motive? Tell us.
Well, he had a background as an undertaker. Even the RCMP say he admitted that he can make people disappear. I met a contractor who worked on his warehouse property who told me there were strange little fire pits all over the property that gave him the creeps, that it's all part of the mystery. And then there was another fellow who went missing in Truro, not far away from Portapique. Same thing, who was hooked up with biker gangs in the area and went missing right around this time. So shortly before Wortman starts to go off the rails, the police put out a refresher on this Tony Walsh, who went missing, to remind the public that, you know, he got it last seen getting into a Ford F-150. There's a million Ford F-150s in Canada.
Sure.
Wortman had one too, same color. So it's just around the edges of this story. It doesn't mean anything right now. But all I'm saying is, you know, the second part of my book, Dan, was the search for the truth. And part of the search was for the truth was looking at all the various things that are going on in the community at this time. And there's a lot of creepy stuff going on. And Wortman is a creepy guy. So it's just raising these questions that hopefully we'll get some answers in the future.
You talk about a curious event that happens at the Oslo Fire Department, where a EMO officer is fired upon by a couple RCMP, and then those RCMP eventually leave the scene. And that, what I'm saying is, that's curious in that it has some relation, it seems, to the gas station video. And what you claim is, it seems like that the police had their orders to kill rather than arrest Wortman.
On the Sunday morning of April 19th, 2020, Wortman came down Highway 4 from after killing McLeod, Jenkins, Tom Bagley, and Lillian Campbell Hislop, who was walking down the road going for her morning constitutional.
Right.
He pulled over and killed her. Then he went down to the house of the Fishers, mm-hmm. who are sort of friends or acquaintances. We're not sure what kind of friends or acquaintances. Appears to threaten them, leaves. He appears to be able to hear what the RCMP are doing. The RCMP ERT show up around 10 in the morning, and they think they have Wortman pinned down, but he's already escaped and gone over back up Highway 4. He already passed a Mountie coming down. The Mountie refused to chase him because he was afraid. Then he went down Plains Road, killed VON nurses, Heather O'Brien and Kristen Beaton. But when he was at the Fisher house, the ERT went in there and they asked for what is compromise authority. Compromise authority allows them to shoot someone if they're perceived to be a danger or they're escaping, and does not require a superior to sort of assess the situation and give the order. So it's a thing used in ERT circles. So what we see after the Fisher incident is that it appears that the ERT and some people associated with the ERT, like the two constables who show up about 20 minutes later at the Oslo Belmont Fire Hall, they're driving east on Highway 2. It's virtually impossible to see the fire hall until you're on top of it because of fencing and bushes, speed limits and stuff. The official story is, we thought we saw Wortman wearing a safety vest. Werman was wearing an orange safety vest. This EMO worker, David Westlake, was wearing a green safety vest.
Right.
And there was an RCMP car parked behind him, a full cruiser, with safety cones around him. The two officers said they stopped. He shouted out orders. There were no answers. They couldn't, that the people wouldn't respond. So they started firing at them. And these bullets went everywhere, went through the wall, hit a fire truck inside. Corey Ellison's father was in there. That was a rescue station. So the RCMP shot up this. They did about $40,000 damage. And then they got out and they ran. One went into the door of the fire hall and said, everyone okay? Yeah, took off. And they headed towards Truro, trying to catch up to Werman, who had passed that station about 12 minutes before there. When I went and investigated it, what the police said couldn't have happened. However, the police watchdog, SIRT, Serious Incident Response Team, and its leader, director, former judge Felix Caccioni, issued a report saying it was a clean thing, it was a mistake. They were under stress. And what I saw was they shot from far west of where they said they were, because they hit the sign to the west of the station and caused a lot of damage, destroyed the sign. So it suggested they were operating like snipers, and that they're still operating under this notion of compromise authority. So you have to keep that in mind, that now they were acting like snipers with almost likely a shoot to kill order, because that's effectively what it is, or how they interpreted it. And eventually, when they get down half an hour later or so, no more than half an hour, about almost an hour later, Werman continues on. So you remember a couple of things have happened here. A police officer sees him, refuses to turn around and go after him because he's not prepared and he's afraid. Then they shoot up the Onslow Belmont Fire Hall. They never issue a warning to the town of Truro, that which has its own police force,
right,
to block off the town. Werman drives right through there, right past the hospital where Lisa Banfield is, continues south, eventually ends up shooting at Constable Chad Morrison, killing Constable Heidi Stevenson a few hundred meters away from there, killing Good Samaritan Joey Weber, who pulls up at the site, going another kilometer, killing Gina Goulet, eventually finding his way to Enfield. And when you look at the video at Enfield, the CERT report said, oh, it was a clean shoot. All of these things happened. There was a confrontation. The two officers had this little dance with Werman before they identified him, and then they shot him. Well, we were able to prove with leaked tapes that didn't happen. That happened at Elmsdale, about 6-7 minute drive up the road at another gas station. And they fused these things together. So when you look at the tapes of what happened at Enfield, the police appear to pull up, get out, and just kill Werman and fire like 24 shots into him. And they say, oh, well, he was raising a gun and we had to take him out. And people say, yay, you killed the bad guy. But, you know, dead men don't talk. So it puts to rest the question, like, what was really going on? What was Werman's side of the story? When I look at the tapes, what I see is, and not only me, but others have looked at the tapes, and it looks like Werman has a white napkin in his hand, like he's trying to wave the white flag when they kill him. The RCMP's final version of the story, which just came out this week, was, oh, he was putting a gun to his head to commit suicide, which is a convenient story, because if he committed suicide, then all their actions for killing for shooting him 24 times are moot, because, well, he was already dead and we just finished him off. So it's a clever sort of, or a sinister way, depending on your point of view, of getting away from any thorough examination.
Now, we've listened to your conclusions, but we haven't spoken, before I let you go, about this commission and what they found and what was their conclusions. And I'm, you know, if it's still ongoing, it was delayed from the fall to January. So tell us the status and what is their conclusions?
Well, the commission is set up in a way that they've adopted restorative justice principles, and they're trauma informed, which means they don't want to release anything that's going to cause anyone in the families to be upset.
Right.
The RCMP union went before it and asked that all the RCMP members be exempted from testifying because they're too traumatized by all of this.
Sure.
So this is what's been going on, that they've let out, there's no real testimony in a classical sense. You get people going in, you've had a couple of times where Mounties have gone in testifying in groups of three and two, telling what appear to be well-rehearsed stories without much cross-examination or effective cross-examination because of time limits, to puncture their stories. And they have these, you know, emotional hero victim type stories. You know, one guy's a hero, the other guy's a victim. And even the lawyers and the families involved are, you know, the other day, Josh Bryson, one of the lawyers representing the Bond family, got up and said, this is not transparent. This is, you're playing games here. You know, and, you know, the Rob Pinio, another lawyer who represents most of the family, has said the same thing. Observers have said that. We had a lawyer, a Queen's Counsel, a senior lawyer in Halifax, wrote a piece in the Halifax Chronicle Herald last week saying that it's not transparent. It's a cover up. And that's why I wrote my book. I could sense this was going to happen. And that's why I boldly say in the title, it's a cover up. And it's all sort of dovetailing in that direction. And people outside, you know, other than me, can now see it. And they're speaking to the record about this, or speaking on the record about this.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Paul Pelango, for coming on and talking about your book, 22 Murders, Investigating the Massacres, Cover-Up, and Obstacles to Justice in Nova Scotia. It's been an absolute pleasure. Is there a website or some way that people might find out more about this or contact you?
They can contact me at paulpelango@protonmail.com, which is an encrypted service. You can just have to track me down. I don't have a website yet. We may do a website, but, you know, on Facebook, you can find me on Facebook. It's not hard to find me. Look either under Pelango, Dispersing the Fog, my previous book, or McNamara Pelango, my wife and I together. I'll get back to you. People find me from everywhere.
Thank you very much, Paul Pelango, 22 Murders, Investigating the Massacres, Cover-Up, and Obstacles to Justice in Nova Scotia. Thank you very much. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
Keep your space feeling comfortable this summer with help from Menards. The Denali Air 6000 BTU window air conditioner has a 3-speed cooling system with remote control, allowing you to control the temperature of your space from anywhere in the room. You call the shots with auto and eco mode to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Stop by in-store or online at Menards.com. For more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Good night.